Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here on the program with the same name. Isn't that funny? My name's Mike Malloy, and I host the Mike Malloy Show every night.
Damn.
Jamie emailed in today, said, a 900-foot-tall Oral Roberts told me to listen to Malloy tonight and that it would be good. Jamie is very much a cynic. Somebody else wrote in and said, fire up the furnaces. Oral Roberts has stepped into the infinite. I don't even want to talk about it. Howard Dean and a couple other people have pretty much made the case today that it's time to just kill this health insurance reform idea. Just kill it. It's going to cost the Democrats probably the House and the Senate in the elections next fall. It's going to be a real cataclysmic event for the Democratic Party. And I think that's good. And I don't mean that to be unnecessarily cynical. But the Democrats had a perfect opportunity. They've had several over the past year and a half to assert not just their power, but the power of this Democratic Republic. And they chose to get along, go along, to be cowards, to deal with a piece of waste like Joe Lieberman, to the point where Lieberman now is able to almost single-handedly bring health reform in this country to a screeching halt. I don't care what Tom Harkin is saying on Rachel Maddow's program, even as we speak. But it is time to just punt. Drop back 10 yards and punt. You know, when it's fourth and long, what are you going to do? After a meeting, was it today, Obama came out and acted all brave, but you could tell by the hesitancy in his voice that he understands, too, that like Hillary Clinton, his chances of reforming the health care system, health insurance system in this country is dead. It is completely dead. Now, there's a lot of postmortems already beginning, which may be a little bit premature, especially in light of the fact that tomorrow Senator Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist from Vermont, is going to introduce an amendment that is, well, for the first time in American history, it'll be a proposal to create a single-payer Medicare for all healthcare system. And there will be a debate on it. I don't think it's going to last very long. Sanders says, quote, in my view, the single-payer approach is the only way we will ever have a cost-effective, comprehensive health care system in this country, end quote. The Sanders Amendment would provide health care and dental coverage for every American. It would save money. It would improve health care results. Everything is there. Everything is right there. So Sanders acknowledged today that his amendment will not pass. He said, quote, as a result of the power of the insurance and pharmaceutical industries, this amendment will not pass or even get very many votes. Nonetheless, given the view of millions of us that a single-payer approach is the only way this country will ever provide comprehensive, cost-effective health care to all its citizens, this is an important step forward. I can tell you what it says. I'll get to Lieberman in a second. The there's a summary available at Bernie Sanders' website, but the summary is the amendment would establish a single-payer health insurance system that would cover every person legally residing in the United States. The single-payer system would be regulated and funded by the federal government through a payroll tax and an income tax, but it will be administered by the states. It would replace the coverage and revenue titles of the current bill, but it would leave in place most of the provisions in the quality prevention and workforce titles of the bill. The amendment starts from the premise that health care is a human right and that every citizen, rich or poor, should have access to health care, just as every citizen, rich or poor, has access to the fire department, the police, and the public schools. Why is the amendment important? The United States spends over $7,000 per person on health care, which is almost double the amount spent by nearly any other industrialized country. Despite this fact, we still do not insure all of our citizens. The United States ranks among the lowest of developed countries as far as health outcomes, according to both life expectancy and disease metrics. It goes on, but it starts from that premise that healthcare is a human right. It's not something to be administered by for-profit thugs who cheat and lie and steal from people and the government. The biggest scandals other than the banking industry have shown up in the healthcare industry. You're aware of that, the health insurance industry, I should say. That's where the biggest scandals are. Other than banking and finance, it's the enormous amounts of money that are used to administer Medicare, Medicaid, and healthcare, health insurance in general. The biggest scams, money scams, occur there. So, for the same reason that Willie Sutton robbed banks, that's where the money was. The health insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry do not want their piggy bank smashed. And it will not be. So it raises a question, and Robert Perry, the investigative reporter who writes at consortiumnews.com, it raises a question, what the hell is motivating Joe Lieberman? Seriously. What, why is he doing this? Is it his ego? Is it his pettiness? Is it his wanting to be in the catbird seat? Is it his insatiable desire for publicity? What is it? Well, Perry says no one is mentioning the unmentionable, the cause that has come to define Lieberman's career, Israel. Israel? Perry says, is it possible that Lieberman's obstructionist behavior doesn't relate to Connecticut's insurance industry or to his political ego, which are the, you know, the two most cited explanations, but rather to a calculation that he can use his leverage on healthcare to limit the pressure that President Barack Obama can put on Israel to make concessions on a Mideast peace plan. And then and Perry raises the issue about Lieberman. I mentioned the other night that it's astonishing to me that Lieberman, who is the number one Zionist in the U.S. Senate, and he is, supports ardently, with his life probably, given that choice, a country that has single-payer, universal health care, Israel. And yet Lieberman will do anything to stop it in this country. It just doesn't seem logical. I couldn't get my mind around it. Well, Barack Obama's approval rating in Israel is in the single digits. Because Obama, even though he is continuing to escalate war on Muslims, Obama is seen by the Likudniks in Israel, the hard right, which is most of the country, most of the political part of the country, as someone they can't trust. And the reason the Likudniks see Obama as someone they can't trust is because he actually addresses the Palestinian issue. He speaks to Arabs. He speaks to Muslims. Well, that's not allowed if you are a Likudnik, if you are part of the Benjamin Netanyahu crowd. You don't talk to Palestinians. Palestinians are subhuman. Palestinians are seen by the Israeli Jews in the same way that white supremacists in this country look at black folk. They're not human, not fully. Perry says the more common explanations of Lieberman's behavior have holes in their logic. While it's true that Lieberman's constituent Hartford-based insurance companies fear any government intrusion in their industry, the actual proposals for the Medicare buy-in or the tightly constrained public option actually would benefit the insurance industry in the near term. Perry raises some interesting questions here. We'll take a look at them when we come back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The sale from Saturn is here. The best deals ever on a Saturn with $4,000 total cash back on every new vehicle. Or qualified buyers can choose 0% financing on all models. Length of contract is limited. Take delivery by January 4th. Hurry to your Saturn retailer tomorrow. Anyone past the hour, call it the Lieberman explanation. Robert Perry, writing at consortiumnews.com, pretty much either has nailed it or at least raised a very interesting and salient point about Lieberman. As Perry points out, no one is mentioning the unmentionable, the cause that has come to define Lieberman's career, Israel. And Perry asks, is it possible Lieberman's obstructionist behavior doesn't relate to the insurance industry or his political ego, which those are the two reasons mostly cited as to why he's doing this, but rather to a calculation that he can so weaken Obama with this that Obama will have no political capital left to pressure Israel to make concessions on a Mideast peace plan? Perry goes on to say, the public option actually would benefit the health insurance industry that is so much of which is anchored in Connecticut. It would benefit them. So it's illogical for Lieberman to be so against a public option. It would benefit them certainly in the near term. And that's those are those uninsured Americans 55 to 64. Those are customers that the insurance industry doesn't want, because they are part of the population that is most likely to need medical care, right? And that's the reason, as Perry points out, why private insurers have driven up the rates so high that these people can't afford to buy health insurance. Letting these people buy into Medicare wouldn't cost the health insurance industry much of anything, and it would reduce the moral crisis and PR crisis, really, that has led so many Americans to view private insurers as vultures preying on the most vulnerable. So why would Lieberman be against the public option? In fact, as Perry points out, in his past position in favor of the Medicare buy-in, just 3 months ago, Lieberman was in favor of it. Lieberman recognized that reality about private insurers, vultures, as vultures preying on the most vulnerable. He noted that this over 55 age group faces a particular crisis because they have, quote, retired early or unfortunately been laid off early, end quote, Lieberman, and can't afford health insurance. And even though Lieberman has had his pockets lined with health insurance industry money, Perry says that has never before prevented him from favoring this Medicare buy-in. Only now does Joe Lieberman say he would join a Republican filibuster to kill the entire bill if this is included. So Senate Democratic leaders have dropped the buy-in provision to appease this son of a bitch. They've dropped it. It's gone. Now, in the same manner, as Perry points out, Lieberman has protested any inclusion of a government-run insurance option, right, the public option, even if it's only triggered by the failure of private insurers to offer affordable alternatives. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that only about 6 million people would sign up for the House version of the public option, whose rates would likely exceed those of private plans because the sick would gravitate to the government plan. So this would give the insurance industry another break. So what's going on here? Why is Lieberman opposed to the Medicare buy-in and the public option if he is a pig, a shill for the insurance industry? It is illogical. It doesn't make any sense. So what's the deal? Perry says it's Israel. Israel. Perry says Lieberman may not be serving the industry's best interests by jeopardizing passage of a health reform bill. Not only does the industry stand to pick up tens of millions of new customers who will be forced to buy insurance, sometimes with government subsidies, but a decent reform bill also blunts demands for more radical change. So why is Lieberman doing this? The insurance industry will gain Nothing. In fact, if Lieberman succeeds here, then in fact, they will be put at greater financial risk. The insurance industry should be calling Lieberman up and saying, "Get out of the way, dude. We want this, son of a bitch." That's why you've not heard the insurance industry really come out strongly against this. So for all these reasons, the Lieberman is in the pocket of the insurance lobby explanation isn't convincing. Which brings us to Israel, which, as Perry says, arguably has become Lieberman's most treasured priority in his political life. And I'll share with you what Perry said about that when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy.
To hang out together. Listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
25 before the hour. Back to Robert Perry's suggestion or insight or whatever you want to call it, that the reason Lieberman is so opposed to two aspects of the health insurance reform bill as put together by Democrats is the fact that they would weaken Obama if they are defeated. Public option and Medicare buy-in, both of which Lieberman in the past has supported, A. B, both of which the health insurance industry would like to see come into law because it would save them a lot of money. So why is Lieberman doing what he's doing? And the answer, to as far as Robert Perry is concerned at consortiumnews.com, is that Lieberman is the most ardent Zionist in the United States Senate, and this is a very direct attempt to weaken Obama. Because I think it's conventional wisdom that if nothing happens here with health insurance reform, and it appears nothing is going to happen, that that will make it easier for the Israelis to not respond to any pressure that Obama might want to apply to the Likudnik government of Benjamin Netanyahu. And again, remember that Obama's approval ratings in Israel are in the single digits. The Israelis don't like him because he has the unnerving habit. Well, first of all, there's his name, especially his middle name. And it's not Irish, his last name, Obama. Secondly, he talks to Muslims. He talks to Palestinians, to Arabs. And the Likudniks say, no, you do that and you are betraying the state of Israel. Perry says Mark Vogel, or Perry writes, Mark Vogel, chairman of the pro-Israel National Action Committee, once said, quote, Joe Lieberman, without exception, no conditions, is the number one pro-Israel advocate and leader in Congress. There is nobody who does more on behalf of Israel than Joe Lieberman, end quote. As Perry points out, it was Lieberman's embrace of neocon ideology and his support for wars against Israel's Muslim enemies, the likes of Saddam Hussein, that led Connecticut Democrats to deny him the Senate nomination in 2006 and prompted his successful run as an independent from that state. Now, Perry says, partly because Obama opposed the Iraq War, Lieberman went on the stump for Republican John McCain in 2008, even questioning Obama's patriotism. Remember that? In August 2008, standing with McCain, Lieberman called the election a choice, quote, between one candidate, John McCain, who has always put the country first, worked across party lines to get things done, and one candidate who has not. Lieberman says Obama was a person who has not always put the United States first. Now, that is holy writ for politicians. You put the United States first, no matter how many children we incinerate, no matter how many wedding parties we blow into red mist, no matter how many countries we invade, illegally occupy or overthrow, the United States can do no wrong. Absolutely none. Well, Obama, according to Lieberman, has not always put this country first. Therefore, he is very suspect. He might be a communist. Where was he born anyway? Perry says, since the start of Obama's presidency, Israel's hawkish Likud government has made no secret of its concern that Obama might pressure the government of Israel into making territorial and other concessions to the Palestinians and Syria to secure a Mideast peace agreement. And in Washington, the still influential neocons, people like, you know, pick a few, they're still there. The most leading, the zombie, Dick Cheney, they've also been demanding that Obama continue Bush's belligerent policies and side with Israel in a hardline approach to Iran, right? Remember, the neocons want war. They want blood, as long as it's somebody else's blood, and their precious bodies, their precious sons and daughters and wives and husbands don't have to participate. Send the country's minorities over to fight. You know, the Latinos and the other brown people have got to have something to do with their time. Send them over there so they're not robbing convenience stores. Isn't that the attitude? So, in the sense that the neocons are demanding Obama continue the Bush policy, siding with Israel no matter what. Lieberman, Perry writes, and the neocons have much in common with Republicans like Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina, who declared in July that, quote, if we're able to stop Obama on this health reform, it will be his Waterloo. It will break him, end quote. And as Perry points out, a broken Obama would be a lot easier to manipulate regarding Mideast peace talks and Iran, right? If Lieberman succeeds, Perry writes, in sinking Obama's chief domestic priority, health insurance reform, or if Lieberman succeeds in getting it watered down so much that it alienates Obama from his liberal base, Obama may find himself essentially the captive of the neocons, needing their blessing to maintain any political viability in Washington as he tries to continue his presidency. Starting to make sense to you, truth seeker? Perry finishes up by saying Lieberman has been careful not to connect his disruptive behavior on health care reform to his support for Israel. But there can be little doubt that a chastened Obama, either defeated on health care or forced to sign a bill that liberals will view as a betrayal, a chastened Obama will have much less political capital to expend in applying pressure to Israel. A hobbled Obama, Perry writes, won't be able to push Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to halt expansion of West Bank settlements, or to take other steps that might lead to a Palestinian state. Obama also could be pushed around himself if Israel, which is an undeclared nuclear power, if Israel decides to launch airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. The Israel explanation, Perry concludes, for Lieberman's behavior on health care reform is the one that seems to make the most sense. Well, for those of us outside the Beltway, outside the Washington chicanery and backstabbing and intrigue. For those of us outside that nest of vipers, considering what Perry suggests here, has been beyond our reach. I know a couple of you have suggested this, but I think in more of a glancing way, an offhand way, kind of an oblique way. Maybe it has to do. Even I mentioned it the other night about, hey, you know, I don't get it. You know, only I didn't make the connection. I just said all I said. I'm not trying to put myself in the same class as Robert Perry, but I just, you know, I said the other night, what is it with Lieberman? Everybody knows he's an ardent Zionist. He's one of the biggest supporters, if not the biggest. Of Israel in the U.S. Senate. He's an Orthodox Jew. He believes what he believes. That's his business. But you know how the application of pressure by the Jewish lobby in this country, the Israeli lobby, I should say, against American politicians is unrelenting. And Obama is seen as an absolute threat to Israel. Expanding its territories, refusing to, or its settlements in the territories, refusing to work out a peace agreement, with these subhuman Palestinians, which is how they are seen. Obama is not seen with any favor whatsoever. Bush's ratings in Israel, I think, were in the high 80s. No matter what he did. Obama's hasn't even, at this point, they're below 10% approval. And the 8 or 9% of Israeli citizens who support Obama, are, for the most part, I would assume, people in the peace community in that country who understand the necessity of a two-state solution that is fair and equitable. Although neither side would see such a thing ever as fair and equitable. That's why there is no solution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So there you have it. I find what Perry writes to be eminently considerable. You know, it bears consideration. And as Perry points out, you know, when you get into this area of discussing the overt influence of the Israeli lobby on members of the U.S. Congress, or the actions taken by members of the U.S. Congress in support of Israel at the expense of their own country. When you bring that up, you are immediately, I'm waiting for the emails to roll in. Malloy, you anti-Semitic son of a bitch. May all your children rot in hell. I'm waiting. We'll be back. Or something like that. Who knows? 10 before the hour. As we mentioned earlier, Greg Sargent, writing at the Plum Line, points out that Howard Dean has bluntly called for the so-called health insurance reform bill, the Senate bill anyway, to be killed. Dean also denounced it as, quote, the collapse of health care reform in the United States Senate, end quote. So it really is kind of a sad situation when you take a look at Obama's lack of courage in this, and I can see it no other way. He didn't grab this issue around the throat and threaten to strangle it unless people woke up and figured out a way to really, truly reform health care, health insurance in this country. And that would have required a single-payer system. It was just too much. Obama just was not the man to do it. That was never his intention. Just like Nancy Pelosi, it was never her intention to go after the criminals in the Bush crime family. So to a lot of liberals and progressives, and we talked about this the other night through somebody else's blog or an email or whatever it was, that, you know, for the people who think that Obama is a liberal or a progressive, you're out of your minds. I'm not going to say, oh, I was tricked and fooled. No, I wasn't. I said this before. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that my point of view before the election was very clear. That Obama was another corporate candidate. I said that night after night after night. And Hillary, too. And some of the emails I got from people were blistering. People abandoned the program, told me to go F myself, told me they would never listen again because I was a traitor to the Democratic Party. I was a traitor. The one that really got to me, I was a traitor to African Americans. I was trying to stand in the way. You know, that kind of stuff. And all I was doing was reciting almost verbatim Barack Obama's scant legislative history in both the United States Senate and in the Illinois legislature. That's all. And Hillary's, same thing, trying to make the point that these were not liberals, neither one of them. They were not progressives, neither one of them. Not to paint Hillary Clinton with the brush of her husband, but the Clinton administration was one of the most regressive Democratic administrations in the history of the Democratic Party. I mean, that son of a bitch allowed the Republicans to undo 70 or 80 years of social progress in this country. And as a result of Clinton signing off on the ending of the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, whatever it was, we are now faced with what we're faced with economically. So my point back then was simply that Obama was not a liberal or progressive, but I said at the time, quoting Margaret Thatcher when she said about Gorbachev, he's a communist we can do business with, Thatcher said. I kind of parroted that and said, well, it looks like Obama is a Democrat that, progressives and liberals can do business with. And I gave a lot of airtime to people who insisted, well, we got to get him elected, Mike, and hold his feet to the fire. Hello, where's the fire? Where's the feet? So it's not that Obama was necessarily thwarted in his attempt to fashion health insurance reform, meaningful health insurance reform in this country. That's not necessarily the result of this at all. He wasn't trying to fashion meaningful health insurance reform at all. If he wanted to do that, if he wanted to be a radical progressive, all he had to do was say, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. It's called single payer. You all know what it is. That's A. B, his cowardice, he called it not wanting to repeat Hillary Clinton's mistake of working out all the terms of everything behind closed doors, as she and Ira Magaziner and all those people way back in 92 and 93, until they finally presented it to the Congress, the American public. By that time, media and right-wingers had broken it into a million pieces, and it died. And the stench from that is still noticeable if you stick your head out the window and take a deep inhale. Obama said, no, that's not going to happen to me. This is all going to be open up front. I'm going to have the legislative branch do it. Well, okay. But why didn't Obama, see, here we are in the postmortem, why didn't he set out the parameters and say to his political party that control the House and the Senate, this is what it must contain, period. Don't present anything that doesn't have this. Single payer. And with all those points that Bernie Sanders now is going to introduce in a resolution or an amendment tomorrow to make single payer the rule of the law of the land here. And as Sanders said, it's never going to happen. But Sanders is not the president of the United States. Barack Obama happens to be. But Obama did not want to do that. He didn't want to say, I will lead this thing through the House and the Senate. Well, the House and the Senate will make the decisions. as to the gears and levers, and how it operates around the fringes, I, the President of the United States, am insisting, I demand, that after all these years we join the rest of the industrialized world and have single-payer health care to stop this the corruption, to save the U.S. Treasury billions, and to make sure, third and lastly, make sure that all Americans have access to health care. He did not do that. So this plan, Lieberman be damned, and all these intrigues, U.S.-Israel intrigues be damned, this thing needs to be killed. Barack Obama is going to be a one-term president. You know it as well as I do. And you also know what's going to happen in November 2010. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
When did your life start?
Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour on the Malloy program. All right, I want to close out this discussion about health care, the death of the attempt to bring health insurance reform to this country. I honestly don't believe that it will happen until the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives are once again in the hands of the people and out of the clutches of corporate America. And I don't think I'll live long enough to see that happen. So, excuse me. I seriously doubt if there will ever be health insurance reform in this country. Hillary Clinton tried it. And the last time it was attempted was in 1993. This is almost 2010. So it's been almost a generation since it was tried the last time. It's going to be a long time before it's ever tried again. And you know, at the risk of being a cynical bastard, I understand. My feeling is that it will not change until these two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are removed, or at least challenged by progressive Democrats, social Democrats, whatever you want to call them. and that's going to take a lot of work. And I don't know that we have the time or the energy to do that work. So who knows, right? Who knows? ¿Quién no sabe? Who knows? So I want to share with you something that James in Seattle wrote to me, an email, and then we're going to go to your calls, if you like. The number here is 877-996-2556. Mr. Mike, I swear this is my last email to you or anyone else on this subject. It is getting tedious. I was over at a diehard neighbor's apartment who still listens to you and had your show on the other night when you asked, I'm assuming it wasn't rhetorical, why the Susan G. Komen Foundation employs pharmaceutical hack Hadassah Lieberman. Simple. In the case you don't actually know, That foundation funnels money to the pharmaceutical companies, the very same ones which have interdicted studies from taking place to find any connection between the rise in women's breast cancer and the rise in contraceptive use, as well as the rise in breast cancer and the rise in new synthetic chemicals and compounds introduced into the environment without any toxicity studies performed. And there have been over 65,000 of them since the Reagan administration. Since the three main correlating areas, a rise in women's breast cancer, with the rise in mammography tests, with the rise in non-studied synthetic chemicals, with the rise in contraception usage, since they haven't been truly, thoroughly studied thanks to these pharmaceutical industry-pressured interdictions, the mystery remains. A short while back, a highly, and in the news purposely, misinterpreted epidemiology study on breast cancer, with no connection to any industry, suggested that later testing might be advisable due to false positives, together with the still unknown effects of frequent mammography radiation exposure. The industry doesn't like real epidemiology studies which negatively impact their profits. Therefore, it is to be expected that the Susan G. Komen Foundation would continue with Hadassah, as like seeks like. And to recap, the principal aim of this public option is the backdoor bailout of the insurance industry, together with windfall profits for the pharmaceutical industry. When Lehman Brothers went under, at least four major insurance securitizations blew up. Probably a number of others I'm unaware of as well. And they need their bailout to keep those executive bonuses flowing. While the bulk of the pharmaceuticals is tended by J.P. Morgan, with the crumbs going to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, the bulk of the insurance industry is divided between Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, with the residue going to J.P. Morgan. James in Seattle. Now, if you can decipher, and it took me a few minutes, there were a bunch of parentheticals added to his email that would have been too confusing for me to include in a oral recitation. You have to read what James writes sometimes, most of the time. But if you could understand what he was saying, it pretty much dovetails with what you already know, that corporate America has such a stranglehold on the democratic system, it's not a democratic system anymore. By embracing the democratic system, by first getting these paper constructs declared to have the same rights as human persons, as opposed to non-human persons, I guess. Under the U.S. Constitution, the pharmaceutical industry, corporate America guaranteed that it would be impossible to defeat it. Because now you're not fighting against a corporation. You're not fighting against articles of incorporation filed in somebody's office someplace. You are fighting against an entity that has the same rights as you do. You see how this works? So if you want to deny corporations the right to spend billions to back a particular candidate or spend billions to deep six a certain socially progressive idea, if you want to do that, then you've also got to acknowledge it can be done to you. Because you see, industry, the corporations now have the same rights as you have under the U.S. Constitution. the right of free speech, the right not to incriminate itself when it's finally caught in its criminal activity. It can't be forced to testify against itself. Or, well, since corporation is mute, its officers, the little humans running it, can't be forced to testify. You see how this works? So the absolute end of really, come on, you know this. You're way ahead of me on this. The absolute end of people democracy in this country was when the Supreme Court declared some time ago that corporations had the same rights as human beings. And since they are wealthy, though, mega wealthy, a billion, trillions of dollars at their disposal, they do not, at the same time, have the same obligations as their human, real human counterparts. If you and I are sued for something, we can resist as long as we have money. And when we no longer have money, we can no longer resist, and then a default judgment or whatever is issued against us, and we lose, and we go bankrupt or whatever. If a suit is filed against ExxonMobil, or against Exxon, I should say, for defiling Prudhoe Bay, or not Prudhoe Bay, but, oh, hell, it's so long ago, wherever the Exxon Valdez spilled, they can stall it for decades, which they have done. They can buy off justice and replace it with rulings favorable to Exxon. You and I can't do that. So the deck is stacked. You know it's stacked. It is not just stacked. It's also stacked and loaded. You and I, as individuals, thinking that we still have the protections of the U.S. Constitution, are kidding ourselves. We're kidding ourselves. Because if you have a right to scream when someone's assaulting you, and the person assaulting you has an equal right to scream that, well, no, in fact, you are smashing his fist with your face, where's the justice? What's to be decided? Equal is equal. Fair is fair. Right? So, it's probably time to leave this topic. I don't know if I really can. It's been intriguing. I actually believed at the beginning of this year that there would be comprehensive health insurance reform in this country. I actually believed that an effort would be made, if not from Mr. Obama, at least from progressives or Democrats in the House or the Senate, to bring single-payer health care into reality in this country. I actually believe that. I should be ashamed at my age, still believing in the tooth fairy, still believing in Peter Pan, still believing in, you know. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Like in the USA, and all I did was complain. Living here is paradise. He taught me paradise is in your mind. You know that there's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay the lag. You better thank God for that. There's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay the lag. You better thank God for that. There's hope. Every time I turn on the TV, there's hope. Somebody's acting crazy. There's hope.
Short to listen to Right Wing Radio, here's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. There's something else completely out of context is what we're talking about tonight, but I want to share with you. You can find this at commondreams.org. Walter Troches, who is a gay activist in Honduras, has been assassinated. Now, to a lot of people, the next statement is, so what? Who is he? Don't know what the hell you're talking about. You probably don't, but I think this is worth mentioning. He was 25 years old. He was a well-known lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered LGBT activist in Honduras. He was an active member of the National Resistance Front. His sexuality was secondary to the fact that he was an active member of the National Resistance Front against the coup d'etat there. He was assassinated Monday night, shot dead by drive-by killers. This young man, who had already been arrested and beaten for his sexual orientation after participating in a march against the coup, had been very active recently in documenting and publicizing homophobic killings and crimes committed by the forces behind the coup, which is believed to have been the motive for his murder. He had been trailed for weeks before his murder by thugs believed to be members of the state security forces. In an open letter documenting this wave of political assassinations of Honduran queers that he'd written last month, entitled Increase in Hate Crimes and Homophobia Towards the LGBT as a Result of the Civic Religious Military Coup in Honduras, he had written, this young man had written that, quote, once again, we say it is not acceptable that in these past 4 months, during such a short period, 9 transsexual and gay friends were violently killed, 6 in San Pedro Sula, 3 in Tegucigalpa. End quote. At the end of this open letter, Trochez declared that, quote, as a revolutionary, I will always defend my people, even if it takes my life, end quote. Sadly, that's what happened. So for anyone who's paying attention, and I realize none of us are, none of us are paying attention to the situation in Honduras. This was a man who was a young man, very young, 25, member of the National Resistance Front against this military religious coup that occurred down there, also active in lesbian, gay, and transgendered rights. And he has been shot dead on the streets of on the streets in Honduras. Just wanted to include that in our list of atrocities for this week. Okay. By the way, Amnesty International has issued a statement calling for an investigation of the murder. And I think we all know that bless Amnesty, but nothing will happen. Sheila is in Tempe, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Sheila.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
I want to thank you very much again for my podcast, which I won several weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just thrilled with it.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good. Anyway,
I just had a couple of comments I wanted to make.
Okay.
You had asked me to call back after, you know, I refused to stand over there all night waiting for her, but I did go and talk to some of the people waiting in line.
For the book signing, sir.
Yes.
Okay.
And here's what I found out. One is a man behind me was using his cell phone, and he was saying, "I have 30 pictures of her. I hope she runs for president."
Sheila. He said he had 30 pictures.
Yeah, while he was waiting in line.
Or dirty pictures.
Well, he didn't say they were dirty.
Oh, he said 30.
He said that he had 30 pictures waiting. He was so excited. She didn't even pretend to get out of, the bus?
Right.
Out of a limousine. But anyway, I had a reason for bringing these people up. Another one, I heard one man say, "There's a lot of right-wingers here." And so I thought maybe he was a left-winger. So I said, "Oh, are you a right-winger?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "Are you?" And I said, "No."
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say I was a left-winger. And then a woman turned behind and shook her fist in the air. "I'm a right-winger, and I'm proud of it."
Ew.
Now, these are the kind of people. Now, I remember back, you had a man call you last week. Where I remember last summer, you were saying for a while, "Let McCain win," and all this.
Mm-hmm.
But the night Sarah Palin had been nominated, McCain had introduced her earlier today, and you said you had changed your mind. And I'm just telling you, we can't, if people abandon Barack Obama now, we also need him in for 2 terms so he can nominate judges for the Supreme Court. Otherwise, if liberals abandon him, you're not going to find a liberal. You're right on that. You won't find somebody like Bernie Sanders. You won't find somebody like Dennis Kucinich. And listen, as far as Hillary goes, I think she would have even been more warlike because of the very fact she was a woman, she wouldn't have wanted to be perceived as weak. So what alternative do we have? If people don't vote, you're going to get Sarah Palin in there next time.
Well,
or somebody like her, and then Congress is going to, you know, to say nothing about judges.
Okay, well, look, Sheila, I've had this discussion so many times my head hurts. I appreciate your point of view, I really do. That is the standard point of view held by people who are Democrats, that, you know, we have to go with these lousy bastards because if we don't, X, Y, or Z will happen, or probably all three. That's all well and good, and I hear you loud and clear, but as far as I'm concerned, I've just had enough. I can't play that game anymore. I really can't. If we get fascist judges appointed, then it's up to the people to remove them. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Hey, truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. This is the Malloy program. Back to your phone calls. Arthur is in Cape Coral, Florida, listening on XM. Hey, Arthur.
Yes, how are you? Last time I talked to you, I was in Shanghai. Now I'm back in the States. But anyway, as I was telling my friends,
yeah,
watch Lieberman, because he's going to kill it, and it has to do with Israel. That's how I summed it up. When I heard you say that tonight, I said, damn, I guess I'm not an anti-Semite after all. Because, you know, I'm afraid to talk on the same level, because, you know, got friends who will say, oh, you're just anti-Semitic, Art. And I said, wait a minute, no, look, it has to do with Obama not playing ball with the Israelis on those settlements. You're putting a little too much pressure on those settlements on the West Bank. So anyway, I'm glad to see that you came out with a report that basically says what I was telling some of my friends all along. He'll kill health care if it helps to weaken Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a guy that just finished 2 years ago taking care of a wife for 29 years on dialysis. So I know the torturous path that it takes to take care of someone in the system we have, because I've been through that, and I'm still recovering from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the insight, Arthur.
Yeah, there's not much I can say. Where do we go from here? I mean, I agree.
Where do we go from here? No place. We just continue, to try to make a living, try to live our lives.
Yeah, not lose your home in the process after you turn 55, right?
Well, that too.
Because the insurance rates will go from $800 a month to $1,500 a month.
Right. Right.
And they're going to charge us for all this, by the way. This isn't over. I mean, just killing the health care reform is only the beginning of the rape and pillage we're going to see in the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, eventually, maybe, the people who are being oppressed, people who are being oppressed to the extent that a lot of people may start to feel they're oppressed in this country, eventually they will rise up and say no more. You know, we're just not going to take it anymore. We're not even where near that point yet, but, I don't know. I see attempt to reform after attempt to reform being thrown in the trash, whether it is the financial services industry, whether it is the banks, whether it is the health insurance industry, no matter what it is.
But
whether
don't they see that by not taking action on things of, you know, important things for the country that benefits the country and makes it competitive in a modern world. I mean, I'm seeing what's going on in China, and I've been to Europe, and I'm telling you, if these Neanderthals think that they can play around like this with the economy and with the social net, they're going to lose out in the long run. They're not going to be ahead of the game with anyone down the road.
Who's going to lose out?
The top 10, the top 1% of the folks here.
They'll never lose out. What do you mean, Arthur?
They lost their manufacturing base, and they think they're going to keep what they have in China. It's not going to work that way.
Well, I don't think, I don't know. Maybe you're involved here in deep thought. I only go as far as saying that the top 1 or 2% will never lose what they have.
If the national economy,
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. National economy, national shikonomy. Nobody, you know, we don't deal with national economy anymore.
Yeah, I guess they can just go somewhere else and.
Right. Well, the ultra wealthy. The real ruling class in this country, they don't deal with American manufacturing, American farms, American anything. It is globalized now. This is the wonder of globalization, that the ultra wealthy, the whole damn planet could collapse, I guess, financially. It wouldn't hurt them a bit. Hey, I got a boogie. Thanks. I appreciate what you had to say, Arthur. I wouldn't worry that, and I'm not trying to be a smartass here, but I'm just saying, I wouldn't worry about that top 1%. They are anchored, into enough, deviations where it concerns capital markets and capitalism. They will never, ever, ever, ever be broken. Never. Got an email here from, who's this from? Ken? This is interesting. You can file this however you want to. Mike, the Susan G. Komen Fund for the Cure was created by her sister Nancy Brinker. Susan got breast cancer and after much suffering died tragically. Then later Nancy also came down with breast cancer, but she survived. Nancy and Susan were raised Jewish in Peoria, Illinois. Nancy married twice and divorced twice, and the second husband was Norman Brinker, the multimillionaire founder of Bennigan's Steak and Ale, or Bennigan's Steak and Ale and Chili's restaurant chains. Come on, Mike. With the money from her second husband, she was able to create the Susan G. Komen Fund for the Cure. She and her husband were big campaign contributors to George W. Bush. Nancy seems to have done a great deal of good work in the anti-cancer field. But since she is Jewish, and since Hadassah Lieberman is an Orthodox Jew, that may be the simple reason for why Hadassah is working for her foundation. It might also be a reason why Brinker would be loath to fire her. Who knows? Ken. Well, okay, the tribal blood is thicker than water belief, I guess, kicks in there. I just find it stunningly astonishing that an organization, Susan Komen Foundation, you know, working to, I guess, the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation works to defeat breast cancer or cancer, period. Why it would continue to have Hadassah Lieberman, whether she's Jewish, Catholic, or atheist, you know, or someone that believes in reincarnation. What difference? I'm not challenging Ken's email. I understand what he's saying. But in the larger picture, what difference should it make if the husband of this woman that you are paying is doing everything he can to destroy a public option that would assist more women in dealing with this scourge of breast cancer? That's the part that is so incredible to me. But what do I know? Steve is in Austin, Texas, listening on XM. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Kenneth kind of beat me to the point. He came at the same conclusion somewhat from a different point of view.
Uh-huh.
Consider this. CARE, isn't that the Israeli PAC?
CARE?
Support Lieberman. And
Wait, CARE.
I don't mean CARE. I mean the Israeli lobby.
AIPAC?
AIPAC, there you go.
Okay.
That's Lieberman's professional meal ticket. Hadassah is the personal meal ticket. And you've kind of tied it up in a nice little package that is fairly simple to comprehend. And Ken nailed it, sort of, I think. Don't forget that the Jewish bloodline, doesn't it continue through the maternal side? Who's the real Zionist in the family?
Well, I get what you're saying, but the only thing is, I'm just worried that we're getting a little bit far afield here. Ken's email may be solidly grounded. Maybe Ken's Jewish. I have no idea. The only reason this issue of religion came up tonight was because I found what Robert Perry wrote at Consortium News. Not only understandable, but very possible / probable that the larger effort here. It's so weird sometimes to talk about this particular issue because everybody gets their bloomers in a wad as soon as you start talking about it. This is one of the unmentionable. You're not supposed to talk about this. Come on. But, you know, the person who did the most damage to the U.S. security agencies, which might be a good thing in the long run, was Pollard, who was spying for the Israelis. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. I guess when you have gone through what the Jews have gone through for, 3,000-4,000 years, you do become, if not paranoid, extremely watchful to the point where you, when you have a country like the United States with the power to blow anybody off the planet, you want to make damn good and sure you know what that big country is going to do, hence all the spying. The Soviet Union, I guess, the old Soviet Union, the same way. You know, I don't know. I just find Perry's explanation reasonable that what is going on here with Lieberman, because the explanation or the thought that Lieberman is doing this because he's working for the insurance industry, the health insurance industry, doesn't make sense when you take a look at the bill. When you take a look at what is actually in the bill, it wouldn't hurt the insurance industry at all, the health insurance industry at all. So, you know, you're left with something. What's the reason? Perry, who is a lot smarter about geopolitical intrigues than most of us will ever be, just comes up with a simple explanation. And don't forget Occam's razor. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. By the way, just for the sake of argument, it really doesn't matter anymore, but the Center for Tax Justice did some calculations, and the tax legislation enacted under George W. Bush from 2001 through 2006 will cost this economy, or will reduce the amount of tax revenue collected by the government by $2.5 trillion. Over the 2001 to 2010 period. This includes the revenue loss of $2.1 trillion that results directly from the Bush tax cuts, as well as the almost $400 billion in additional interest payments on the national debt that we have to make since the tax cuts were deficit financed. Okay? $2.5 trillion. That's what George Bush spent of our money. Over the upcoming decade, 2010 to 2019, the cost of the health care proposals approved by three committees in the U.S. House are projected to be around $1 trillion. $2.5 trillion in tax cuts. And who did the tax cuts benefit? All the liberals and all the progressives and all the Democrats kept screaming it's only going to benefit the already wealthy, which is exactly what it did. To the tune of $2.5 trillion of real wealth that accrued to the ultra wealthy, and real debt that accrued to you and me, and people like us. On the other hand, as flawed as these plans were, the Health Insurance Reform Act or bills that were passed by three congressional House committees would have cost $1 trillion. So go figure. And under the House bills, roughly half of that $1 trillion would be offset with savings in our existing health care programs. And the other half would be offset with a surcharge on the incomes of the extremely wealthy, the ones who glommed up the $2.5 trillion. But this is why there really isn't, until the system is utterly replaced with one that is involved in justice, economic justice. Until that happens, just like Bernie Sanders says, I'll go ahead and introduce this amendment, but it's not going to go anywhere. The Congress of the United States, the House and the Senate, are both wholly owned subsidiaries of corporate America. And until, if ever, we get them back, it's going to remain that way. And you and I and millions of people like us, if we choose not to take to the streets, which we probably will not, then the second choice is to adapt. You know, it's the old Darwinian thing, adapt or die. So I think that's what it's come down to. Damn, I'm stumbling around tonight. I'm sorry. It's come down to that, adapt or die. The other choice is to change it, you know, to change it all. But I don't know. The really fiery rhetoric doesn't come from, with a few exceptions, doesn't come from the young people who are capable of those kinds of revolutionary acts. But the fiery rhetoric comes from people who have already been there, done that, and it would be very difficult for them to, wind up their pacemakers and grab their crutches and wheelchairs and go out and overthrow the government. That's just not, I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't. You know, it almost happened 40 years ago. But those people 40 years ago were 30. How old are they now? Right. So. Doug is in L.A. listening on Sirius. Hey, Doug. Where's Doug? Well, he's not there. We'll try again in a second. Maybe Doug's over here. Is that you, Doug? Well, no, that's not Doug there either. We had two Dougs up there in Los Angeles listening on Sirius. That's interesting. James is in Cave Junction, Oregon.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, James.
Oh, boy. Where to start? See, okay, Obama, if you're ready to put on your tinfoil hat.
Sure.
Okay, Obama, the Republicans ran McCain and Palin as a weak candidate right off the get-go, so they have somebody as a scapegoat for a full right-wing takeover in 2012. And until we get up in arms and finally reboot this country, you know, it's just going to be more of the same.
Well, what do you suggest when you say reboot the country? What would you do?
Reboot the country? Insurrection.
Well, but people are not going to do that. You know, one of the primary reasons for destroying the middle class in this country is to ensure that there is no insurrection. That's where revolution or insurrection always comes from. It doesn't come from poor people. It doesn't come from people who are beat into the ground. It comes from the middle class. Always has. I don't care who you look at. Look at Mao. Look at Che Guevara. Just pick your revolutionary. Look at Marx. Look at Lenin. Now, these are not poor people. These were intellectuals or professionals. They were doctors. They were writers. They were thinkers. Hold on a second. Let me put you on hold, James, and we'll pick it up when we come back after this break. This is the Mike Malloy Program. Stick around.
Country that's safe, in a land that's clean and free, for every color and culture, every person, every being. Your greed, your fear, and your lies ain't gonna push me around. I'm gonna use the power I have. I'm gonna vote you right out of that house, 'cause I am a patriot.
about 7 past the hour. It's the Malloy Show. If you're keeping track. Michael sent this in. Do you know yesterday something very significant occurred? The United States Supreme Court refused to review a lower court's dismissal of a case brought by 4 British former detainees against Donald Rumsfeld and other senior military officers for ordering torture and religious abuse at Guantanamo. The lower court had dismissed the case. 4 of our former torturees brought this case. They were the 4 people, British, spent more than 2 years in Guantanamo. They were repatriated to the UK 5 years ago. The Obama administration had asked the court not to hear the case. The Obama administration had asked the court not to hear the case. Now, again, this was a civil case. I don't think this is the John Yoo case. I think this is a different one. The John Yoo case was, I think it was the Padilla. Was it Jose Padilla? I know it looks like it should be pronounced Padilla, but I've been told that in this case it's Padilla. Anyway, the Obama administration had asked the court not to hear this case by 4 British citizens, glommed up, sent to Guantanamo, tortured, and apparently their religion was abused at Guantanamo. But the Obama administration said, no, 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 don't hear it. Now, by refusing to hear the case, and the U.S. Supreme Court agreed, I guess, by refusing to hear the case, the U.S. Supreme Court let stand this earlier opinion by the D.C. Circuit Court, which found that something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a statute that applies by its terms to all persons, that this statute does not apply to detainees at Guantanamo, which effectively rules that the detainees are not persons at all for the purpose of U.S. law. Now, the lower court, the D.C. Circuit Court, had also dismissed the detainees' claims under the Alien Tort Statute and the Geneva Conventions, finding that the defendants were immune, Donald Rumsfeld and the military officers, they were immune on the basis that, quote, torture is a foreseeable consequence of the military's detention of suspected enemy combatants, end quote. Do you understand that? Rumsfeld and the people being sued are immune, according to the D.C. Circuit Court. These war criminals are immune on the basis that torture is expected when the military, our military, detains suspects. People suspected of being enemy combatants. The term enemy combatant is a made-up term. There is no such thing that I'm aware of in U.S. law, in international law. Remember when this came up 6-7 years ago, when the Bush crime family said, well, you know, they're not entitled to any rights under any jurisdiction because they're not, you know, they're not soldiers. They're enemy combatants. They're not civilians. They're enemy combatants. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has, by not ruling, but not even hearing the case by the D.C. lower court, has effectively declared, and this will be used, that detainees, A, are not really persons. They are non-persons. Where have you heard that before? A non-person. They're non-persons, and that torture is a foreseeable consequence. It is to be expected, not assumed, but expected when the military detains people suspected of being an enemy combatant, of being a made-up term. It is expected of people who are suspected. Torture. Son of a a bitch. And then finally, the circuit court, the one that the U.S. Supreme Court refused to review, the circuit court found that even if torture and religious abuse were illegal, even if it were, the defendants, Donald Rumsfeld and his gang, were immune under the Constitution because they could not have reasonably known that detainees at Guantanamo had any constitutional rights. Oh, my God. So between the D.C. Circuit Court and the United States Supreme Court with its inaction, the D.C. Court with its action, and the Obama administration, we now have a class of non-being. It may walk and think and sing and cry and pray and fart like a human being, but it's not a human being. What are you going to believe? The D.C. Circuit Court or your lying goddamn eyes? What are you going to believe? We now have declared in this country that certain people who were classified as an enemy combatant, a term that exists nowhere, now we've declared that enemy combatants are not even persons. U.S. corporations have the same rights as persons, but people that we scoop up in Afghanistan or Iran or the high seas or Iraq or Syria or wherever we scoop them up, they have no rights. U.S. corporations do have rights. Through the looking glass? Are you kidding me? This is where we are. So for the people who I put myself among them, who have been plaintively, crying out about the unfairness of it all, forget about it, all right? Adapt or revolt, I don't know, adapt or die, revolt or suffocate, I don't know. It's, again, I don't think there has ever been in the history, certainly not the recent history, say 70, 80 years of this country, a clearer choice. Adapt or revolt. Is there a third one? Just conduct business as usual? Well, in doing that, aren't we adapting? When our courts have the power to declare human beings to be non-persons, who wrote about non-persons? Was that in the Gulag Archipelago? Was that Solzhenitsyn? Who was it? Was it... I guess a lot of Soviet writers who were out of the country, who were not going to be captured and put into a gulag. I guess that isn't that the term? A Soviet non-person? Is that where that comes from? A non-person? I just find that one a little bit difficult to handle. Woo! My goodness. Oh, by the way, the four former detainees, the ones who sued, were held for 3 years at Guantanamo before being sent home to England without being charged with anything. You understand? No charges were ever filed. They were kidnapped, detained, tortured, and then sent home. They filed their case 5 years ago seeking damages from Rumsfeld and senior American military officers for violations of their rights. Never charged with anything. Never charged with a thing. But the court has ruled, the D.C. court ruled, that even if torture were illegal, defendants are immune. Rumsfeld's immune because they could not have reasonably known that detainees had any constitutional rights. A, B, the foreseeable consequences of military detention is torture. And now fighting for children, for homes and for
Hey, truth seekers. Here's the truth speaker, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Our military affairs correspondent, Sharon, points out the obvious. Given the Supreme Court ruling, what can we expect then when our soldiers or even our civilians are captured and labeled enemy combatant by the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or some other group? I guess they couldn't be labeled enemy combatants because our people are always dressed in uniform. Oh, wait a second. That's right. No, they're not. So what happens? What happens when one or two or ten of our people, and we don't know, maybe that's already happened. Our right-wing media, of course, would never let word get out. No, they wouldn't. You might say, of course they would, Mike, to whip up a frenzy against the people kidnapped. No, I disagree. This is just something we would not know. So what happens, though, whether we know or don't know, to Americans who are captured and the same rules are applied as have been applied by action of the U.S. District Court in Washington and inaction by the U.S. Supreme Court that would declare our people to be non-persons and not subject to anything, anywhere, about anything? Now, of course, Al-Qaeda doesn't have constitutional law like we do. Of course not. But wouldn't we be screaming bloody murder? I think we would. I really do. Andre writes in about unperson from Wikipedia in the George Orwell book 1984. An unperson is someone who has been vaporized. Vaporization is when a person is murdered by being turned into vapors. Not only has an unperson been killed, they have also been erased from society, the present, the universe, and existence. Such a person would be taken out of books, photographs, and articles so that no trace of them is found in the present anywhere. No record of them would be found. Nothing. The point of this was that such a person would be gone from all citizens' memories, even friends and family. There is no newspeak word for what happened to unpeople. Therefore, it is thought crime to say an unperson's name or think of unpeople. This is like the Stalinist Soviet Party erasing people from photographs after death. This is an example of real unpeople. Jesus God. It's getting curiouser and curiouser, I swear to God. Yeah, so I should have recognized Unperson from 1984, but that doesn't come from the novel, I don't think. That was, I think, what Wikipedia and Andre are quoting there is a glossary of terms that came with as an appendum appendium. Jesus, I can't think of the word. To 1984, a second book. That, not quite a book, but laid out the philosophy of Big Brother and the terminology, how the language was developed, why it was developed, and the way it was developed. It gets into the theories of Big Brotherdom, into the dialectic. Where are we? Right here. James is in Cave Junction, Oregon. Hey, James.
Hey, Mike, back to what you were saying about revolution, we were inches away from a socialist revolution armed in during the last Great Depression. And then after that, when things settled down, what did the right wing do? They McCarthy and them went after the socialists, calling them communists, and ruined their lives. You know, when a man can't feed his children anymore, a man gets angry. And a man gets angry, he does things. And just like, you know, the French, you know, starvation is, if you're not used to starvation, is a cause of revolution.
What is the cause?
Starvation.
Yes, but it's a cause for people perhaps to join a resistance movement. But the leadership of a revolution, the people who actually put it together, give it life, breathe life into it, are not people whose children are starving. Because there is, I'm not trying to be cute here, but there is no time to think revolution when your children are starving. If you are a rational human being, you are doing everything in your power to find food for your children. You know, the so-called Okies during the Dust Bowl days were a classic example of that. These were people who were literally starving to death. And they were trying to find, well, you read Grapes of Wrath, I'm sure. They were trying to find a place to live. They were, if you remember how that movie was put together, they were depicted pretty much the way Steinbeck had them in the book. They were very malleable. You could do anything with them. You could knock them around. You could deny them their money. You could kick them in the ass, and they didn't respond. No, I understand what you're saying. The frustration can build to the point where somebody can get murderous. Somebody can, you know, run into the street with a loaded gun and start firing because everything is collapsing in their universe. Somebody can walk into a bank or a department store and demand money and start shooting. You know, people can go nuts, but real revolution always is led, unless somebody wants to challenge that statement, I'm open to it. But as far as I've read history, it's always, always led by people who are from the middle class. That's one of the reasons that our slaughter of the middle class in Iraq was so horrible. We didn't need to invade. All we had to do is support a middle class until people finally said they had enough of the dictator. That's true anywhere, isn't it? Oh, my. Thanks, James. We'll be right back.
This is a special.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
With Mike Malloy, indeed. All right, back to your phone calls here in just a second. It's 25 before the hour. Michael in Roswell writes, regarding the Democrats and Republicans, we are never going to be without the defenders of rapacious capitalism or the partisan apologists for corruption. We don't have choices about those things or about the pervasiveness of their views in popular media. We don't even have much say in who ends up running for office. The state and national party machines are much more influential than we're willing to admit in this regard. The circumstances that led to Lieberman still being in the Senate, for example, provide some justification for that view. The only way to marginalize the people the system promotes is to stop giving them money and votes, even if it means we spend another two or three decades living with the result of that, while building a national organization which can drive out the moral and ethical corruption that is pervasive in government today. The difference between the two dominant party machines today are ones of relatively small degree, not kind, but degree. So continuing support for one or the other will not improve the situation in that time period. Things might get worse in the short term, but logic prescribes that the best way to solve a problem is to understand the root problem and solve it, rather than to continue to treat symptoms as causes. The root problem is the misperception that one of the two dominant parties is preferable to the other, when in fact both parties continue to promote and benefit from a vastly corrupted system. Well, that makes sense. Thank you, Michael. Yeah, that's more or less the Ralph Nader point of view. It is the point of view, I think, that one comes to when one says, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to participate in a system that is so corrupt any longer. Even if it does mean that refusal to participate will ride all sorts of night riders and highwaymen who will swing the country even further to the right. And yes, like one caller said tonight, it means, right-wing Supreme Court justices. Well, what do we have now? I mean, come on. Can it get much worse? Probably, possibly, maybe. Okay, certainly. But if the goal is long term, if the goal really, and this is a goal that will not include me, but if the goal is really over the next 30 or 40 years to institute justice in this country, which we've only taken swipes at. Come on, you know that as well as I do. Economic justice, social justice, whatever. Whatever modifier you want to put with it. We all know, or should know at this point, that justice in this system, this society, is two or three tiered. And those of us who are on the lower middle tier, okay, maybe more than two or three, maybe it's like six tiered. Those of us who are on the lower middle tier occasionally get justice if we happen to get a sympathetic hearing. I'm not talking about in the courtroom. You know what I'm talking about. But the vast majority of people in this country do not get justice ever. Whether it's about their jobs or their education or control of their lives or whether or not they get health care or an examination or a trip to the doctor or the dentist. You know, whatever, however you define justice, I define it as an equal application of opportunity as well as the law. I mean, that's all. That's all just those things that I thought were guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or the Federalist Papers or somewhere back there. You know, there's got to be something in there that's So the plan, as Michael rightly points out, and I think most people who are not interested in the delusion of next month's profits, the plan is long term. And when you take a look at the length of time and stack it up against somebody's life, it's probably half a lifetime. Now, whether or not that dedication in large enough numbers of people to change the system will actually appear is that's the open question, right? And like I say, a lot of us who are talking the talk will not be able to walk the walk for a very simple reason. We won't be here. It's outside our temporal boundaries, I guess the way to put that one. Doug is in L.A. listening on Sirius. Hi, Doug.
Mr. Malloy, my friend.
Hey, what's up?
To everybody I know, I call you the truth.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, my poor brother's delivering food. He got the Kings game right now. He's dying. He's like, I hate this every time.
I know. That's just the way it goes with KTLK. There's nothing we can do about it.
They go above and beyond. It's serious, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I called to talk about Obama.
Yeah.
And the problem is, like, such painful things happen every day that we put our faith in these politicians, like, it's going to be okay, let's just do our thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never the case. There's a two-headed dragon always been. And, I mean, since you denounced it, honestly, I denounced it. That's my thing. I mean, like, the Democrat, I don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't call it. And it's like the faith has been lost. And, compassion for one another is, like, it's not even here anymore.
Right.
You know, it just bothers me. I'm in Los Angeles, so it's like a whole new traditionalism of 400 years ago is right here now, and it's a whole different thing. So it's like borders, whatever it is, it's still America. I mean, I'm a good American such as yourself that I want to preach the good, and like what would happen to Thomas Jefferson's, and I mean, I'm not talking about rapists and racists and stuff like that, but what happened to the good American? You know what I mean? Like the Hunter Thompsons, maybe.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Too crazy? You know, I don't want to die at 60. I'm not getting greedy, but you know what I mean, brother?
I do know what you mean. I do know what you mean.
Honestly, people don't even put on blinkers when they turn. To me, that's like a fuck you to humanity.
Oh my God. No, you can't do that. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're listening on Sirius, but we're also going over the air, you know, so I know you know that. I know. I had to cut you off.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid. Just say that.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid. Thank you, Head on Radio Network, for providing us with that piece of equipment that we never could have afforded on our own. Never. Anyway, I get what you're saying, and what you're saying is absolute truth, and I appreciate you saying it. And your language doesn't offend me. It's just that, you know, I've got certain rules and regs I have to go by. All I need is one FCC complaint. And one of those, what is it now? $350,000 fines. Woo! Oh, they would never get me because I'm not, you know, I mean, we have a corporation that protects us, but that would certainly put us out of business. So all the little right-wing jacklegs right now writing that down. Oh, Malloy, oh, that's how we get him off the air. Oh, good, let's file an FCC complaint. He said the F word. Oh, bite me. Anyway, to our caller, no, I hear what you're saying, and I'm in total agreement. Just be cool. Be cool with the language. Mike is in Chicago. My man, Mike.
Hey, Mike. Uh-oh, someone needs an audio Band-Aid, it looks like.
Yeah, see, you
it
guys...
didn't offend me, too. I get as riled up also.
Right. You guys listening online, you could hear everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and it definitely got my attention, but yeah, in a pleasant kind of way.
Right, absolutely, absolutely.
You know what? One thing no one's talking about, though, is I think for any of the future things now for next year, so many Democrats are going to lose their seats.
Yes.
We can say goodbye to the defense of marriage, the don't ask, don't tell. And if Obama would have taken care of these early on, it would, at least he would have those in his resume.
Well,
but now all he's got is a losing health bill, and he would sign a napkin at this point just so he could say, I'm the first president in 50 years to have any kind of reform.
Right. But this is where guys like you and I kind of didn't get the original point, and that was that Obama, you're from Chicago, you know Chicago politics, you know Obama is not a liberal.
I tried to get him into office. I was out in the streets.
I know. but you also know, or you should have known, as I should have known. Well, we did know that Obama was not your traditional liberal. Or your traditional progressive. Come on, he comes from a strata of society in this country. I mean, come on, Mike. I don't know where you went to school, but I'll bet it wasn't Yale or Harvard.
No. But you know, the one thing that I don't get, and if you YouTube, Chris Rock introduces Obama. He does a 5-minute spiel, and then Obama. The thing that he says, I'm running for president because I'm sick of reading about a Justice Department that doesn't enforce justice.
Yeah, and, yeah.
You know, I'm running for president because I'm sick of Democrats being Republican light.
Hey, hold on this a second. Hold on, Mike. Hold on. We got to do a break. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. The sale from Saturn is here. The best deals ever on Saturn with $4,000 total cash back on every new vehicle. Or qualified buyers can choose 0% financing on all models. Length of contract is limited. Take delivery by January 4th. Hurry to your Saturn retailer tomorrow. It's about 10 before the hour. Back to Mike in Chicago. Now, what were you saying? I lost it.
As far as if you go on YouTube and you just type in Chris Rock introduces Obama.
Oh, yeah, right.
He does about a 2-minute little shtick, and then Obama comes out. And one of the first things he says is, I'm running for president because I'm sick of reading about a Justice Department that
right.
doesn't believe in justice.
Right.
And, you know, I listen to everything he says, and you know, other than Stephanie and Tom Hartman, I can't listen to the radio anymore.
I
listen to audiobooks, and I've been listening to John Dean's Broken Government, and it angers me to a level I can't even put into words of all the things that Cheney and Bush have done, and I was never even aware of.
Mm.
And I'm just, I say to myself, you know, why isn't he legal counsel with Jonathan Turley? You know, I don't understand this.
Right.
And no one has the answers, and the Democrats, and even the Democratic Party, the people aren't in the streets with pitchforks and torches. I just, I don't know. Everyone's just so complacent. It just, you know, it angers me.
Well, is it complacency or is it just, is it doubt, confusion, anxiety, fear? I don't know. I rail all the time about the ignorance in this country, and which I think is there. But complacency, I don't know, Mike. I would like to pick up the pitchfork, the metaphorical pitchfork, and take to the streets tomorrow morning, but I won't. And I don't think it's because I'm complacent. I don't know what the answer is any longer. The answer may rest in all this technology that we have. We do have the internets. We do have the World Wide Web. We do have an organizational power that, you know, the people that landed on the moon didn't have. And I've got it on my PC. I've got it on my laptop. I've got it. So do you. Just the equipment that we have here in this little dinky studio far exceeds what NASA had back in 1969. So.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's just, you know what I think it is also is I think that people just figure, oh, this will all, it'll work itself out because nothing can be as bad as the last administration. So it's kind of like if you're starving, the cracker is the best cracker you've ever had in your life. And that's what it is we've been so badly beaten constitutionally for the last 8 years that finally any resemblance of law abiding, you know, it's the best thing in the world.
Even if it isn't really law abiding, but somebody sent me an email and said after breathing methane for 8 years, it's nice to have at least a whiff of oxygen.
Right.
And Obama, if anything, provides a whiff of oxygen. He may be ultimately as destructive by his inactivity as the Bush crime family was destructed by their activity. But at least for a moment, you know, you take a deep breath when you see Obama walk out on the stage and you say, damn, I can breathe again.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and I want to believe that one day he is going to do something. But I'm just afraid that by the time he gets around to doing it, we're going to lose so many seats in the Congress that we're not going to be able to get anything passed. If we can't do it now, like the saying goes, when will we? We'll never get another chance at presidency.
Right. Well, the you know, the real I hate this metaphor, but the real bull in the China shop is global climate change. There's all kinds of stuff happening in Copenhagen that we've not been covering. I'm going to try to devote some time to it tomorrow. Media are not covering it, except to present it as a slugfest between the United States and China, or the haves and the have-not nations, the rich nations and the not-rich nations. But this attempt in Copenhagen, it should be getting the attention that the nuclear freeze movement got. And it is not. Of course, it took the nuclear freeze movement a couple of decades to get the kind of serious attention that it should have gotten from the very beginning. But you know, all this stuff that we talk about, Mike, it may just be completely moot if no attention, at least effective attention, and solutions are found, and they're there to reverse or at least ameliorate. Or at least bring to a pause this global climate change. We're ignoring some stuff that is just astonishing. I mean, all you have to do is just spend some night watching a program on Nova or the Discovery Channel.
As long as Tiger Woods isn't on it.
Yeah, right. But if you look at these docs put together, these documentaries put together about what I'm laughing because it's gallows humor. It's like that old song that Kathy used to play. We're all going to die. We all know, well, I guess we all know we're all going to die, but nobody thought they would die because of global climate change. I don't think anybody in my generation ever had a clue that there even was such an issue. as global climate change. It only started to get into the popular discussion when? In the late 60s, early 70s? And even then, it was just kind of like, hey, the planet's warming up. Really? Okay, let's smoke some reefer. Yeah, so,
yeah. Well, you know what? Also, I think it's because the dumbing down of society. In the 60s and 70s, there were sleep-ins and everything else. And now, the kids watching MTV and VH1, and they have no idea. Anything about politics.
Well, I know, and maybe that's a survival instinct. Hey, I got to go, Mike.
Okay, Mike, take care. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah, I don't, you know, and thanks for not saying the F-bomb. And again, Bob Kincaid knows what I'm talking about. Thanks to that piece of equipment, Bob, that delay thing that that we use here and have been using since we went solo. Stick around for Bob Kincaid's Head on Radio Network program, a rebroadcast of which comes up following this on the White Rose Society stream. You ain't heard nothing unless you've heard the Bob Kincaid program. I'll see you tomorrow night, Truth Seeker, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Things.